This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Remembering Bush 41. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Behind the scenes of a lasting friendship between the late President George H.W. Bush and one of his trusted advisors.
Regarding a popular gift this holiday season, will smart speakers ever turn to paid advertising? Hear what marketers are doing.
Options to you decompress if you're worried about flight delays in the coming weeks, like a service that functions as an airport Sherpa.
And those awful striped pants of the 1990s that were popular with football fans are making a comeback for some reason.
They were popular amongst athletes, as, you know, they had been from the start, but those athletes became bigger names, which included Dan Marino of the Miami Dolphins. It included Jim Kelly of the Buffalo Bills, and it included a wrestling group called the Road Warriors.
Jacob Gallagher, the Wall Street Journal in the Zubaz pants. He's here in about 20 minutes. There's a good story about a behind-the-scenes relationship involving former President George H.W. Bush, who was buried Friday. It's written by Ledge King at USA Today. His father, Nicholas Leroy King, had a special relationship with Mr. Bush, advisor, confidant, biographer, most of all, friend. He was Mr. Bush's press secretary and advisor in the early 1970s when Mr. Bush was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. He died some 25 years ago, but Ledge found some notes that Mr. Bush had written his father. Ledge explained the relationship.
He was essentially a spokesperson for Bush when Bush was the ambassador to the U.N. back in the early 70s. But really, their relationship was much more than that. They were friends, advisors, confidants. My father ended up writing the biography of Bush in 1980 when Bush first ran for the presidency, and nobody really knew who he was. So the Bush folks said, well, we need to explain to the country who this guy who could be the next president is. And so my father was essentially asked to and commissioned to write a biography on his friend, and he did that.
Wow. So your father, as you mentioned in the story, unfortunately passed early a couple decades ago, but you found these notes that the two had exchanged, which was really cool. Explain some of those.
Well, yeah, and these were notes we found when we knew that they had a relationship and a friendship. My father invited them over to our house once back in the 70s. So, I mean, I knew that the relationship existed.
Okay.
But I didn't know the extent that they shared words as much as they did. Both of them were men of letters, essentially. Bush was famously known as a prolific letter writer, somebody who always thanked people, not just with a word, but with a note. And my father as well always believed in writing, a lost art. So when he died, I went through, we were going through his papers, and we found a number of back-and-forth notes. The ones I put in this story are from the 1987-88 Bush presidential campaign trail, but they corresponded with each other, you know, for decades, and that was just a small part of that.
We're speaking with Ledge King, Washington correspondent at USA Today. He's written a neat piece about his own father's relationship with the late President George H.W. Bush. You got to tell the story of how your father is dragged along to this summit in Governor's Island, New York.
Right. So he was, at the time, he was the director of something called the Foreign Press Center, and which I think still exists today. And it's an office, a government, U.S. government office, where foreign journalists who come to America, and often they're based in New York, not Washington, because of the U.N., because of the importance of New York City as a national, as an international destination, and fashion center, mm-hmm. financial center, etc. So he was ushering in these foreign journalists at the December 1988 summit. This is after Bush had won but before Reagan had left office, and Gorbachev was there, and there was a moment where Gorbachev, there's a lot of small talk in these photo ops, and Gorbachev turns to Reagan and says, "Why do they call this Governor's Island? You know, off the coast, off Manhattan." And Reagan did not know, and he turned to Bush, who also did not know. But he saw my father in the background, and my father, old New York family. Bush knew that my father would know the answer, and in fact, my father did. And that was that the Governor's Island was given to the local governor for his pleasure and enjoyment. My father later said, and this is not in the story, that had he not known the answer, he would have made something up. Because he was totally on the spot, and I don't know was never an appropriate answer when the right. when the leaders of the world are asking you a question.
That's funny. Explain the time too where you took a photo opportunity with Mr. Bush because of that relationship with your dad.
Well, the day after he died. This is in December of 92, and again, it was after Bush had lost his reelection to Bill Clinton, but before he left office. But my mother got a call at her New York apartment saying the White House is on the phone. The president wants to talk to you, and it was Bush sharing his heartfelt condolences about the loss of his friend, also the loss of her husband, and. My mother told me the story, and I was not at the house at the time, and I wanted many years later, or at least I wanted to catch up with him and thank him personally. I don't think I'd ever met him before, at least I don't remember. And so I got a chance. He was in Richmond. I was a newspaper reporter in Richmond at the time, and he was making a campaign stop for his son. And I asked Governor Jim Gilmore at the time, a Republican who was helping to shepherd this thing, whether I could, you know, maybe slip in and say thank you. And they let me do it, very much to my gratitude. He said, come take a photo with me. And I did, because it would have been awkward to say no.
All right. Thanks, Ledge King, USA Today Washington correspondent. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Learn about the best state to start or grow your business at michiganbusiness.org. Google Home and Amazon Echo speakers do not run paid advertising, so brands like HBO, Procter & Gamble, Tide, and Oral-B have approached the devices in two ways. The New York Times says some are trying to crack the code on search results and make sure that their products are mentioned first when users say they want to buy a specific item. Others are creating games that entertain people or tools that provides some sort of service, like directions for how to get a wine stain out of clothes, in order to build loyalty or name recognition. Analysis from Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Rob, what's happening here?
Well, so what's happening is a lot of companies figure that since there are 22 million of these things in the market, and they're supposed to be in 50% of the households by 2022, that maybe we could use these things to sell stuff. Now, Amazon's really not all that interested in selling anything but what Amazon sells, and mostly they're focused on allowing you to order stuff over the device when you need it. So far, they haven't pivoted to advertising. Google says they're not going to pivot to advertising either, but I kind of believe that at some point they probably will, since Google makes its money from advertising.
Yeah.
So it's a different model. But what they're trying to do is figure out ways to interject the product in things you ask for, at least initially. So if you want to ask for instance, how to remove a stain from a piece of clothing, you might get advice that tells you how to use Tide to remove that stain. Also, they're using it to help you better integrate with the product you have, which makes a ton more sense to me long-term. For instance, ROB has an app that you can load, or a skill you can load on an Echo device, that times your toothbrushing to make sure that you brush long enough on every quadrant. So it's a way to kind of offload some of the things that happen on a more expensive electric toothbrush to the device to kind of help you brush properly, which I think is probably a more appropriate way to use the device and connect you back with the brand and your product. And of course, as we get the smart capability, I mean, the article just talks about the fact that smart speakers, but from the car I'm picking up, hopefully, fingers crossed, on Monday, it has Alexa built in, and so I'll be able to talk to the car and get recommendations, and certainly it may push me to certain restaurants and chains over others based on the relationship that the app has with those restaurants. So, for instance, rather than pointing me towards a Taco Bell, it might point me towards a McDonald's or something along those lines. So my hope, of course, is it will learn that I actually like tacos more and won't point me to either one and actually point me to a place that actually makes real tacos.
Right. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm, The Enderle Group. And we're talking about marketing through smart speakers. These things basically are used for simple tasks, right? Order me paper towels, amount of paper towels. How complicated, though, will they get based on some of the examples you've given so far?
Well, these things are going to get increasingly smarter. So, I was actually watching a show on Amazon Prime, one of their shows. I think it was Electric Dreams series, which they created just for Amazon Prime. And one of the episodes was the future of smart speakers, where you did have ads, which was kind of scary. But the ads rendered a 3D avatar, and that's what sold you. And part of it was the fact that bunch of guys figured out that the avatar for a particular cheese was a gorgeous woman who would talk to you and flirt with you a great little time. And the guy's wife was hooked on an avatar that was connected, I think it was the popcorn, or something, no, it was coffee, was connected to coffee, and it was a Eurasian male, very handsome, and she was hanging out with him and didn't want to hang out with her husband anymore. And he was basically that, selling coffee, and so you open the cupboard and all this coffee fell out. So the affair was with the brand, not with the person.
Right, right.
And it started to set back. Well, if that's the future, I'm not too sure that's the future I want. But the argument, at least the article is trying to make, is the fact is that as these things evolve, increasingly they may become advertising platforms. As I say, I'm not convinced Amazon's going to necessarily go that way aggressively, because they just want it to be a storefront. If it's going to be an ad, it's going to be an ad for something that they're selling or want to deal with. Where with Google, since they make their money off of advertising more broadly, they're much more likely to pivot that way because that's their model.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle at The Enderle Group. It is 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Football supporters, pro wrestlers, and even supermodel Claudia Schiffer wore them in the early 1990s. Now they're making a return. We're talking about the Zubaz pants. Where'd they go and why are they back? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Popular with athletes and football fans back in the MC Hammer days, Zubaz zebra pattern pants are making a comeback. Jacob Gallagher of the Wall Street Journal has written a story about this trend and joins us now. Jacob, how did these pants get their start back in the late 80s?
So they got their start, two men that owned a bodybuilding specific gym, Dan Stock and Bob Trax. They were in the Midwest, and they had this gym, and they opened it, and they had found that amongst their clientele, which were larger men who were really quite muscular, clothes did not fit them particularly well, and so they invented these pants that were far roomier. They do have a MC Hammer-esque fit. I thought of them as kind of like ballooned lounge pants, if you will. And what they found was that originally, you know, because these were men who were obviously in the gym and they were not, you know, in an office, they could kind of wear whatever pattern struck them, which meant louder things typically. These were kind of often bigger personalities. A lot of these guys were wrestlers as well. So what they found was that when they would use a zebra stripe pattern, it would do particularly well. And eventually they decided to make their own zebra stripe pattern, which is the distinct, if you look at a pair of Zubaz, they are a very specific kind of zebra stripe. It's a bit abstracted. And that was developed by an art team that they hired. And they developed that pattern, and that became kind of the patented signature pattern for Zubaz. And from there, it spread. They were popular amongst athletes, as, you know, they had been from the start, but those athletes became bigger names, which included Dan Marino of the Miami Dolphins. It included Jim Kelly of the Buffalo Bills. And it included a wrestling group called the Road Warriors, which were also partners in the gym with the two men. And from there, it trickled out to fans, and fans, you know, became really into them. And all throughout this time, certain fandoms were still wearing their Zubaz, even as the brand went dark through kind of the late 90s into the 2000s.
We're speaking with Jacob Gallagher of the Wall Street Journal. Jacob, how did the pants get so seemingly connected to the Buffalo Bills, maybe more than any other team?
So Jim Kelly was wearing them, and you know the brand itself was not founded in Buffalo. The brand is from Minnesota, and what ended up happening was that Jim Kelly wore them, and he was this big star of the Buffalo Bills back in the 90s when they were a much better team than they are today, and fans caught on to them, and you know the Bills happened to be one of those NFL teams that has a very rabid fandom. They enjoyed the louder style of pant, and it just kind of became stuck with them, and it became an integral part of that fandom and their look. So that actually, you know, it's funny, the idea for the story actually came from a colleague of mine at a different section here at the paper who walked over to my desk one day and said, you know, have you ever been to a Bills game? They wear a ton of these Zubaz pants. And I thought, I've never even heard of those. I'm originally from around Washington D.C. and you know these pants are not popular amongst Redskins fans, and they are not as popular amongst New York fans where I live now. But they are very popular amongst upstate New York fans.
So they kind of had a lull in the mid '90s. What is bringing them back now?
So what's bringing them back is that, well, first of all, Mr. Stock and Mr. Trax both found that in talking to, you know, their family members and in people that would find out that they own Zubaz, that there was still an interest in the brand. So around 2009, they started hearing about this. They decided to revitalize the brand. They had actually sold off the name of the brand. They bought it back from one of their original partners who kind of just wound up with it when the company dissipated.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Jacob Gallagher. 30 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Dell's dedicated small business advisors give you tech advice and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. And now's the time to save on select business PCs with 8th-gen Intel Core processors until the end of the year. Maximize this year's budget and find the right tech solution for your business. Plus, get free shipping on everything. Visit Dell.com/businessdeals or call 877-BUY-DELL to talk to a Dell Small Business Advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, professional money managers taking us for fools. Also, binge-watching Hallmark Christmas movies this time of year, and your stress-free guide to holiday travel. We'll have some tips in about 20 minutes. Well, the regular season is over, the bowl matchups are set, and now we have weeping and gnashing of teeth over which teams have been left out of the college football playoff, plus a call to expand the format from 4 to perhaps 8 or even 16 teams. Sports columnist Greg Moore at the Arizona Republic says too many people are having the wrong debate, first off. However, he says the University of Central Florida, undefeated in 2 straight seasons, has a gripe that merits consideration since it has not been invited to compete for a national championship. Greg, what do we have?
Look, what we've got is a playoff system where teams from the largest conferences have an opportunity to compete for the national championship. We've had this playoff for 5 years now, and in the 5 years, we've never had a school outside of what they call the Power 5 conferences, with the exception of Notre Dame, but everybody recognizes Notre Dame as a part of the ACC for a lot of different reasons, plus Notre Dame's just Notre Dame. Table that for a second and consider a school such as UCF. Well, nobody beats them. This is their second year in a row. They're kicking everybody's tail, and they don't have an opportunity to compete for the national championship. And is that not unfair on its face? Okay, then the other side of that argument is, actually, but do we really think that a school like UCF, a school that doesn't compete at the highest level of college football competition, could reasonably compete with Alabama, could reasonably compete with Clemson, could reasonably compete with these larger, more traditional powerhouse schools? If a school such as UCF Boise State before it, Utah before it, wants to make it to that top tier, do they need to prove that they're a dominant program rather than just a flash-in-the-pan great team? Now, those are the two sides of the argument, and I've got thoughts about what we ought to do with that.
Okay, so for me, like a kind of casual observer here, it strikes me that the season is so long. You want to add a couple of playoff games, maybe trim a couple of regular season ones so you're not wearing these kids out. They are students, after all.
That's a piece of it. And for me, that kind of segues into what I think ought to be the thing we're discussing. If we're talking about reforming or overhauling college football, why in the world aren't we picking the biggest fish that needs frying? Why aren't we picking the biggest fight that we can fight to do the most good? Why aren't we focusing on the needs of the student athlete? If you expand the playoff to 8 or 16 teams, that means more teams will be driven to function as pro football factories, the kinds of places where there is a lot of pressure on coaches. Therefore, there will be a lot of pressure on student athletes, and it is not the kind of pressure that translates to the classroom. It's the kind of pressure that translates to the field.
We're speaking with Greg Moore, sports columnist at the Arizona Republic, part of the USA Today Network. He's written an interesting piece about the University of Central Florida, undefeated now for the second year in a row in college football. And he says, does UCF prove it's time to expand the college football playoff to 8 or 16 teams? Kind of break this down, I guess, to this simple, like typical sports argument here. Can UCF compete on that level with an Alabama or a Clemson?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Right? I mean, look, the history of sports is riddled with David and Goliath stories. That's why we play the game, right? That's why the NCAA basketball tournament has so much intrigue. We look at the so-called Cinderella teams. Every year, there's a team nobody's ever heard of from a state that's not a state,
right,
from a school with four or five directions in its name, a state named after a guy. Like, we don't know these schools. And then they step up and they compete at a level that shocks us all, and that's something that we love to see. Again, the history of sports is riddled with these sorts of stories. So can UCF compete with Alabama? Sure, why not? But again, that to me is not the thing we need to be talking about. If UCF continues to do what UCF is doing, there will be a solution. A few years back, Utah forced its way into the Pac-12 in part by being so dominant in its class, in the athletic class that it had been competing in.
Yeah.
These sorts of things sort themselves out. But again, we've got to be focusing on the student athletes.
Thanks, Greg. That is Greg Moore, sports columnist at the Arizona Republic. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. If the stock market decline resumes, we'll soon be reading articles about remorseful everyday investors bemoaning their earlier foolishness. No doubt some folks have been foolish, but mostly personal finance expert Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com views these articles as patronizing garbage that propagate the myth that all amateur investors are clueless and all professionals are super savvy. So what's the truth? Jonathan, explain.
One of the things that I've heard repeatedly over my more than three decades kicking around Wall Street is that professional investors, we're talking money managers, financial advisors, financial analysts, are all super, super smart, and that everyday investors are basically stupid. You know, you go back through the years and you'll see so many stories about how, you know, when the market goes down, small investors are panicking, they bought all the wrong stuff, you know, they're selling at the wrong time, they're buying at the wrong time. I think this is absolutely garbage. I think it's disparaging of ordinary investors, and it just isn't supported by the facts.
So you say, for example, General Motors doesn't dismiss drivers as hopelessly incompetent. So why does Wall Street get away with belittling clients?
Because it's in their best interest. Amazingly enough, you know, by belittling everyday investors, Wall Street actually generates business for itself, and it generates business in two ways. First, Wall Street can persuade everyday investors that they are incompetent, investors are more likely to hire a money manager or hire a financial advisor. And second, because investors are led to believe that they are clueless and don't understand what's going on, they're more susceptible to buying these super complicated, over-engineered, and typically over expensive investment products that Wall Street loves to sell. So for Wall Street, it's a double win. They make money by persuading investors that they can't handle their own finances.
You say, too, that professionals have shorter time horizons than many of us.
Yeah, as we've rolled through this market decline in the past couple of months, you know, one of the things that I come back to all the time is, so what? Anybody who's in the stock market should really have at least a 10-year time horizon. There have been very few 10-year time horizons over which stocks haven't made money. So why are we getting so hot and bothered about the performance of the stock market over a couple of months? In most cases, we shouldn't be unless we're a Wall Street professional, unless we're one of those financial advisors, unless we're one of those money managers. Because if you are a Wall Street professional, a money manager, a financial advisor, your paycheck does indeed depend on how the financial markets perform over the next year. So if anybody should be inclined to panic over the past couple of months, it's going to be these Wall Street professionals because they have a huge incentive to limit their stock market losses because those losses directly affect their paycheck.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com. We're talking about his piece called Taking Us for Fools, and he's writing about professionals on Wall Street. You said, too, they're the ones that actually drive stock prices, which sort of connects to your last point.
Yeah, the typical amateur investor makes very few trades, maybe two or three a year at the most. Meanwhile, Wall Street money managers, they're turning over their portfolios at rates of 100% a year or more, meaning they're replacing every stock in their portfolio over a 12-month period. Estimates I've seen have put the amount of trading by the professional investment community at north of 90%.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Devoted watchers of Christmas movies on the Hallmark Channel acknowledge that similar events unfold really in each movie, like inclement weather tending to strand people in idyllic towns with names like Evergreen. There tends to be a scene where the characters bake Christmas cookies. Plus, in the end, the two leads fall in love while relishing in the spirit of Christmas. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Katie Bindley. Katie, what have you found?
People are obsessed with Hallmark Christmas movies. They can't get enough of them and binge watch them the way that you would like a great Netflix series or The Sopranos or, you know, The Wire. And so I basically learned that, you know, there's people who are putting them on at breakfast and then all of a sudden looking up and realizing it's dinner and that's the only thing they've done the entire day.
So I'm one of those, and don't take my man card. I will occasionally, if my wife is watching, check out a Hallmark movie. But what
You're
is it about
alone.
Them? They're so predictable, though. And after a while, I'm like, why am I watching this? I knew in the first 2 minutes that woman and that guy were going to, you know, be together at the end.
Yeah, not only are they going to end up together, but, you know, the big city girl is going to decide to go back and live in her hometown and give up, you know, her job that she seems passionate about, but apparently is not making her, you know, happy enough. And there's going to be some kind of misunderstanding around the 145 mark that's supposed to make us think that maybe they won't end up together, but it is always resolved in the last 15 to 18 minutes of the movie, and they are extremely predictable. One thing I found when I talk to people is that that's one of the things that they like about these movies. They find the predictability comforting and like reliable. And some people kind of have, you know, told me that they found this, like one woman actually used the term, like, this is like self-care for me.
We're speaking with Katie Bindley, Wall Street Journal personal tech reporter. She's done a piece on Hallmark Christmas movies and how addicting they are. How new are these? Are there new ones that come out each year?
Yeah, so this year, so they make what I consider to be kind of an insane amount each year and add to the catalog of them. So this year, there were 22 new ones that aired on the main Hallmark channel and another 15 on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, which is another network. Oh. At this point, they've built up, there's more than 150, and so what this results in is them being able to air them almost around the clock.
One of the great angles in your story, you found these two young women at Iowa State University.
Yes.
A spreadsheet of like characters and shows and their favorites and rankings and all that?
Yes, they ranked, they had, I don't know, they had like over 10 categories that they used to rank the movies, And one of their categories was, does the movie make you want to cry, throw up, or both? Which I think really highlights how what we were talking about, you know, the cheesiness, the predictability. But then they had quite a focus on the male leads, and, you know, they evaluate him on his, quote, romanticness and his ability to pull off a sweater. And my favorite, one of my favorite moments while reporting this was when I asked them what their favorite one was that they had watched so far and ranked, and their answer to that was A Gift to Remember, was their favorite. And the girl, Allie McGuire, said, "We rated that one off the charts. Our scale is 1 to 10, and I rated it 16 out of 10, and Rachel rated it 15 out of 10.
Thanks, Katie. Wall Street Journal reporter Katie Bindley. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Many December travelers are stressing about anticipated airport delays this holiday season. MarketWatch has tips for minimizing the stress. It says those flying should arrive at least 3 hours before their flight to give themselves plenty of time to check their bags and get through security. Also, download the airline app and enable push notifications so that you're aware of any changes in your flight plan or boarding gate in real time. And skip airline counters whenever you can. Check into your flight and print out boarding passes at home, or have boarding passes sent to your phone so you can walk right up to security. If you're delayed, the Lounge Buddy app offers instant lounge access at hundreds of airports, starting at $25. And many airlines let you buy day-long passes to their lounges for around $50. Also, if you know you're going to be waiting for a few hours, then hop the airport shuttle and explore. Other airline terminals may have a better restaurant, shopping, or entertainment options. Or splurge $100 for an airport VIP concierge like Black Lane Pass to whisk you from curb to seat. It's like an airport Sherpa. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.